Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Happy Earth Day, everybody, and happy belated 420. Hope both events treated you well. On the show today, I speak with dancer Natasha Powell, and from hardcore punk band Cancer Bats, I chat with Liam Cormier about the 10th anniversary of Hail Destroyer. That's all coming up today on Endeavors. Heard the song Hail Destroyer, the title track off the 2008 album of the same name by Toronto hardcore punk metal band Cancer Bats. This weekend, Cancer Bats celebrated the 10th anniversary of that album, which was critically acclaimed, is probably the band's biggest album, and sort of started a whole hardcore punk movement both in the city and in the country at large. I had a chance to go to the anniversary party on Friday at Dying Alone Records, which also saw the release of Cancer Bats' new secret album, The Spark That Moves. I had a chance to speak with lead singer Liam Cormier about the 10th anniversary, what that album means to them, the hardcore punk community, and also the impetus behind releasing this secret album. Here is my conversation with Cancer Bat's Liam Cormier. Liam Cormier, hello, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Hail Destroyer.
10 years.
Yeah, how does it feel?
Feels great, actually. I feel like there's been a lot of introspection and looking back on 10 years. I'm doing a lot of interviews, I guess, about it. So it's been kind of nice to like reflect on how positive everything's gone and how much people, you know, have really embraced the record. So it's great.
When did you decide, like, when did the band decide that this was an album that you were sort of going to celebrate and revisit?
I guess the main kind of thought process was when the 10-year of birthing kind of came and went. And we're like, oh yeah, maybe we should have done something for that. But that record didn't really come out worldwide. Like, it was really important in Canada. And maybe we could have done some shows sort of around that specifically. But that was sort of where the thought process started. We're like, you know what, maybe Hail is the album. Because a lot of things changed for us with this record.
You know, I talked to a lot of bands, and we talk about how the second and third albums are often more difficult to make than the first. What did Hail Destroyer mean to you guys?
I think we learned so much in making Birthing the Giant. I think that was like the first, you know, full-on, real, full-length album that any of us had actually made. So when it came time to writing Hail and working on that album, it was like we already knew what we wanted to fix about Birthing. So that was kind of like our mandate. Like, okay, this is what we found was missing. These were sort of some of the like pitfalls that we ran into. And we were working with Eric Ratz, Kenny Long, and Gavin Brown. So it's like those are like huge heavy hitters who just like basically like unloaded all this information. So we applied as much as we could on Birthing, but I think it was really when it came time for Hail that we were like using some of these like ideas and like, you know, kind of teachings that they had imparted on us. So,
and a couple of cool things about Hail was just the people that you brought into work. You had Ben from Billy Talent, and I know Tegan and Sarah did a cover of you guys on the bonus.
Oh, we did a cover of theirs.
Wait, that's very interesting because it's two very different styles, but I think a lot of people don't realize how closely similar folk and punk music are at their core.
Yeah, and I think those sisters were super punk in how they approached, you know, touring and the way that they worked on their records. And we found like a lot of their early stuff, like the Con and So Jealous, like those were really inspiring records for us. And we were like, this is really heavy. Like, they're not playing, like, you know, like, fuzzed-out guitars, but, like, a lot of the ways that they were songwriting and the emotionally, like, heavy lyrics and things like that. So we're like, oh, this is, like, something that we can also apply to our metal band.
You guys are playing two shows, at least.
Mm-hmm.
They're both sold out. Do these shows have maybe a bit of extra significance than other shows do because it's a 10-year anniversary, they're sold out, they're in your hometown, you know, a lot of people that have been with you from the beginning are going to be at this show.
Oh, totally. And they were sold out, like, you know, more than a month in advance. So that's kind of, like, really, for us, like, an amazing feeling. Because I think when we look back, like, we did, you know, the Mod Club on the original release, and that show was sold out on the day, you know, and that felt huge. And so it's really nice to come back and be able to do something even bigger and to know that it kind of had that much of an impact on people that they want to come. I mean, part of the idea was when we were at, you know, the Monin, like, I guess they did a 10-year, but they did 4 nights or 5 nights at Lee's Palace. I was at one of those and I was like, man, this is amazing. And I was like, this is like the perfect place where you want to go see, you know, an anniversary show. It's like great sound, great sight lines. And we've, you know, become really close with everybody at Lee's and Collective. So we're like, oh, this is exactly where we would do it. Even though it would be nice to go back to Mod Club to like kind of recapture that idea.
Is there a certain then added pressure when you're doing a show like this just because of everything that is behind it?
I think in preparing for it, there was, and I think we took it really seriously to make sure that we knew all the songs. And luckily, we had a 10-year show already kind of out of the way. We played Manitoba Metal Fest in Winnipeg, and we did a 10-year hail for that just because there was so much kind of anticipation since we had announced all of these shows. So we're like, okay, well, this kind of also relieve some of that like anxiety because we've gotten our first hail show out of the way and it didn't go that badly, so we're like, okay, cool. But we've jammed all this week, and like I want to make sure that these songs that we're playing them as good as people remember them, and as with as much energy as, you know, people kind of deserve for how excited they are.
The shows are at Lee's, and you know, there are a few of those type of venues that have sort of reached icon status in Toronto, Lee's being one of them, along with The Shoe, probably is the other one I can think
Elmo
of.
Yeah, Elmo Combo, yeah.
Playing at a venue that has that much history behind it, what is the significance of that for you as a band in terms of its meaningfulness? And it's because it's so ingrained in the city's culture.
Yeah, well, and I think especially for us, like as kids who would take the Greyhound into the city to come see shows. Like, I remember going to see Superchunk there in, like, 1997. You know what I mean? And, like, going to see, like, Fishbone in, like, 1998. And it's, like, that's, for me, like, you know, was, like, a gnarly venue. And I love that it's still around. Like, some of my favorite shows were at Lee's or the Opera House or the Cathedral. And, like, I'm really stoked that those venues are still around. But, sadly, you know, Cathedral's gone. Oh. It's, like, a furniture store now. So it's like I'm happy that like those like spaces still exist. So like some place like Lee's that I, you know, grew up going to, it's like that's still, you know, a venue we can go and play.
You know, the industry's changed a lot. Like a lot of venues aren't still around. Labels have closed. How much harder is it to be a touring band now versus when you guys first started?
I don't know. I feel like for us, we've always kind of existed on our own, kind of like, okay, we're going to do shows wherever, and we've kind of grown up in DIY. So I think just continuing that, I think we've always sort of been able to like exist outside of any kind of like industry trends. And I think like, you know, especially when Hail Destroyer was happening, it's like that's when a lot of labels, like you said, 2008, that was when a lot of labels were closing down. That was when there was less tours happening. And it's like somehow we managed to like put out this record and be really successful off of it when there was a lot of like, you know, things that weren't happening in a lot of industries. So I don't know. I've always just sort of felt like, well, we've kind of just kind of existed outside of everything and kind of had fun and done our own thing.
How does it feel to be considered sort of one of the fathers or one of the kings of at least the modern hardcore punk scene in Toronto?
I definitely think it's great. Like, we meet a lot of kids who will tell us, like, you know, our video for French Immersion was the first hardcore song, you know, that they kind of got into. And I realized that there was that kind of special time and place. And we have those bands, you know, like, I grew up on Snapcase and Sick of It All, and those bands would always come and play Toronto. And I know the same way that, like, when I have played shows with them or met any of those guys, I'm like, oh my god, like, when I was, you know, in high school, this, like, changed my life. And so it feels really great to kind of, like, have that same sort of impact and to have that kind of relationship with people.
So I guess, like, you guys did something really interesting for this release party in that you released a secret album.
Mm-hmm.
Spark That Moves. What was the impetus to not only sort of releasing the album in secret with sort of not really telling anybody, but also releasing it to coincide with the 10th anniversary of Destroyer?
Basically, like, knowing that we had these shows, and basically this is, to me, like, the OG Cancer Bats fans. Like, these are the people that get it. So, if anything, that's who I, like, want to share it with first. And it's almost like you're thinking of those, like, you know, like, those people that are going to be at these shows. Like, we have, there's a bunch of kids from Cambridge that, like, come out to all our shows. And I'm like, man, I want the Cambridge crew to hear Spark That Moves and to buy the vinyl from us and, like, to get the free hot sauce. You know what I mean? Like, you want, like, that's what you want to share with, like, those fans. And especially, like, those people that have been around for 10, 12 years. it's like, oh, well, you're exactly like the Cancer Bats fan this album was written for. So that was my thinking, was just to kind of be like, okay, and then I'll just turn all these Hail Destroyer shows into like co-album release right. shows, and it'll be sick.
What do you make of the fact that your record label sells both hot sauce and children's books?
Yeah. I do think it's rad. Like, for us, like, we self-released this album, but we still wanted to be working with New Damage and Dying Alone, just because, I mean, we've done so much. Obviously, like, Alexis was on Distort. That was, like, where our first label was. They had, like, connections with all of that. So it kind of just, like, made sense for us to be like, well, this is a new endeavor, but we are still, like, you know, jumping in at the deep end. Like, putting out a record yourself is definitely a lot of work. So for us, it was just like, okay, we got to figure out, you know, what we're doing and, like, what an IRC code is and, like, all of this stuff. So it's been great to have, like, the New Damage, like, kind of family helping us out.
Given that you sort of released this yourself on your own label, how different was that process and that experience for you as a band?
I mean, in a lot of ways, it's been the same, only because we've had such, like, a hands-on approach, and we've obviously always worked really closely with, like, Jen and Distort and everybody when we were going through. And even the deal that we had with BMG for the last record was basically like, we'll just help you guys out with the funding, you guys just tell us what you want to do. So we had already kind of like gotten our heads around a lot of those kind of pieces, but this was nice because then everything became our call. So doing the secret release, we were just like, let's just do this, like make this more fan oriented than anything else. Let's just have tons of fun with it. Let's make 11 music videos and put all those out at the same time too. Like, let's just go crazy with it and just see if it'll work. Like, being our sixth record, we're like, well, every other time we've done the teaser video rollout, whatever, pre-order, it was like, well, why don't we try this? Because we haven't tried it yet. We might as well see if it works.
You know, making a music video can always be an adventure, you know, and bands maybe have two, maybe three. You guys did a video for every song on the album. How exhausting was that process, and what was that like for you to delve so deeply into something?
Yeah, it's definitely been a huge undertaking, and I mean, we definitely reached out to a lot of people, and there were a bunch of videos that I was like, we can't be in them, this is completely up to you, let me know, like, you know, when it's done, basically. And that was like, Can't Sleep was like that, Head Wound was like that, the video for We Run Free, I definitely did a lot of wrangling and was the go-between to my buddy, Jared, who's, like, all of the footage, who's just, like, a wild guy ripping around on a motorcycle, and then giving it to Andrew, the editor, to just be like, okay, make this a cohesive idea. So, there's been different degrees of how involved, and some of them are straight performance videos, you know, so it's been really fun in that, like, you know, kind of, like, not every video is the same, and not all of the approaches were even, you know, similar at all. But it was kind of like a slow sort of thing. As we realized we were getting all of this content and that we had enough to make more than just three videos, we were like, oh, we should actually just like go for it and try and make 11.
In this age of instant access, and you sort of touched on it earlier with this surprise release, where are you at with sort of promoting the album, especially, you know, like, oh, these guys are working on a new album, and you sort of tell your fans it'll be out in 9 months from now, but nobody really seems to care until it actually comes out.
Well, and that was my thing. I looked at a lot of this, like, as a fan, where you kind of tend to, like, there's so much noise happening on the internet, and there's so many different things that are taking your attention. It's sort of like when I'm told something 3 months ago, it's like, to be able to focus on that, you know, with everything else that's happening, you kind of lose track. And then you realize 2 months after the fact, you were like, oh, I never checked out their record. Okay. Whereas this, I was just like, let's just, you know, make as much noise as possible and just try and fill up the space on the internet. We'll take up as much real estate as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And I think so far it's working.
I was talking with Jen and a few other people earlier about the death of Avicii today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and we were suspecting, you know, like, he was, I know he's a drinker in the past, and it was an overdose. And I know you yourself are straight edge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think music, rock stars and punk in particular maybe gets a bad rap in terms of the, you know, either the type of music it is or the lifestyle. For you, what do you think the biggest misconception about punk is?
I mean, maybe that there it is a rock star lifestyle. I still think it's interesting that there's a lot of people that are surprised, maybe who don't know what straight edge is or don't know that, like, this kind of sobriety, like, exists. And I think that's still, like, interesting that there's people that, like, hear our band and then assume that I'm, like, stoned or wasted. Which I think if people want to be stoned and wasted, that's great. But I do like the fact that it throws people for a loop that, you know, I'm not and neither is Scott. And, like, you know, that kind of just, like, plays out of the norms.
Well, especially since a lot of people at your shows are probably in various stages of being stoned or wasted,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially on 420. I feel exactly. Like this show's going to be insane tonight.
So, your favorite song off Hail Destroyer and your favorite song off The Spark That Moves?
I would say, actually, and this has been really fun going back to it, Let It Pour is, like, one of my favorite songs. And it's super fun to play, and I know, like, actually the mentality behind writing it was like literally walking around the streets of Toronto being super stressed out and being like poured on in the rain, and I was just like, I'm gonna make it through this. So I definitely like playing that song again and like remembering like that exact feeling. And then favorite song on the new record, I would say is, I like them all, maybe Space and Time. I think that song's super fun and kind of like a different, really groovy kind of like metal song for Cancer Bats. So I get really stoked. And I like the theme of it. It's that we ruin the earth and we need to get kicked out.
Nice. Well, Liam Cormier, the new album is The Spark That Moves, and it's the 10th anniversary of Hail Destroyer. Thanks so much, man.
Dude, thank you for having me on the show. I will.
Cheers.
We'll all rock it.
That was my conversation with Liam Cormier of the band Cancer Bats. They just celebrated the 10th anniversary of Hail Destroyer, and their new album, The Spark That Moves, is out now. This is Liam's favorite song off Hail Destroyer. This is Let It Pour. Yeah! And that was the song Let It Pour off of Cancer Bat's 2008 album, Hail Destroyer. From hardcore punk metal, we move into dance. And it's Jazz Appreciation Month, and in the lead up to International Jazz Day, there is a dance group here in Toronto called Holla Jazz. And from April 25th to April 28th at the Winchester Street Theater, they are presenting Floored. And Floored is developed by artistic director and choreographer Natasha Powell in collaboration with acclaimed musical director Gerald Heslop. This is the first full-length work by the company, and it draws from the raw energy and improvisational spirit of Juke, which harkens back to the Black American dance halls of the Emancipation era. Powell says that jazz is often viewed as a dance form that blends Eurocentric styles, owing little to the origins of jazz and even less to the jazz rhythms. She says, Floored, audiences will come face to face with the true vernacular jazz of the juke, dance halls that emerged within the 19th century, also known as honky-tonks and half-hour joints. And it's often rooted in West Africa and cultural traditions that are merged with modern hip-hop. People don't I think there's a lot of misconceptions that, you know, jazz is a lot more formal, but in essence it is very loose and does have a lot in common with the hip hop and other dances such as the Charleston and the shimmy and the fishtail. And Floored merges a lot of traditions that Powell grew up with in her Caribbean home, her mother being Grenadian and her father being Jamaican, as well as more modern jazz, tap, ballet, and hip-hop. So I got to speak with Natasha Powell last week about Floored, traditions of jazz, International Jazz Day, misconceptions about jazz, and where she sees jazz fitting in with modern dance culture. This is my conversation with Holla Jazz artistic director and founder, Natasha Powell. Natasha Powell, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So, you are the artistic director of Holla Jazz, and I read that this sort of specific project was born out of an injury?
Slightly to say. I think I'll give you a little bit of background behind that. So in 2012, I believe, I was in a rehearsal and I got injured, so to speak. Sometimes dancing bodies, it happens in the nature of the work that we do. But during the time while I was recovering, I was actually introduced to original jazz dancing. So it was actually during that downtime where I was introduced to a style that I was familiar with, but I wasn't completely aware of. And I actually became way more interested in it during that time of healing. And it actually encouraged me to start a residency in New York where I had a mentor. And through that residency in New York, I was inspired to like learn more about jazz dancing. So that's kind of how the injury kind of spiraled into this new space that I'm in right now.
I know, according to your bio, you studied modern jazz a bit from a young age. But I understand that this type of jazz is a little bit different. How would you describe the jazz you studied that when you were younger versus the type of dance that you're and choreography that you're doing now?
So that's a really great question because I get asked that all the time. So the jazz dancing that I learned when I was younger had more of a ballet influence. So you have to be pulled up, your toes have to be pointed, your feet need to be placed in specific positions. But as I realized actually during my residency that actually original jazz dancing is down and rooted in the floor and is much more inspired by West African dancing, because jazz dancing actually originated in Black communities in the United States, in African American communities, and they were heavily influenced by their West African traditions. So I realized that there was a complete difference between what I learned when I was younger versus what the original style of jazz dancing was. And I was more connected. I found more interest in actually what I was doing in the latter. So what I learned that was a little bit more propulsive, it was improvised, it was energetic. That stuff to me, I think it just, it really spoke to me because I felt like it was something that was close to some of the other social dances that I was doing, like hip hop and house dance. I found a closer connection through there, which is why I actually really fell in love with the earlier and the original styles of jazz dancing that was more connected to jazz music.
You mentioned hip hop, and I think when, you know, the more unknowing or unaware people think of Black culture and Black musical culture, they think of, you know, hip hop, they think of, you know, maybe a little more a street dance. But how do you see the intersection and the connection between what we know as hip hop and what we know as jazz dancing?
I see it as, I like to say that, in my opinion, I feel like jazz dancing is almost like the grandparent of some of these more modern street dances. There's a lot of similarity in the way that the body is presenting and performing the movement. It's down, it's grounded, it's heavily influenced by the music, which is kind of cultural traditions that are passed on from generation to generation. And as the music changes or evolves, the dancing kind of goes within that cultural landscape of the community. So that's why I feel like hip hop is definitely really connected to jazz dance. Like, there's even a lot of specific steps that I'm like, oh, I did this in hip hop step, and then I do it in jazz, and like, this feels like the exact same thing, but just kind of modernized in a different way with a different name. So there's definitely a connection in like the movement, the rhythm, the improvisation, like the propulsiveness of it. They're all connected and kind of coming through this lineage of West African traditions kind of brought over here.
Now, I know your background is Caribbean, and that it's its very own distinct culture. How much would you say of that musical background and culture influenced your own style and choreography and career?
Oh my gosh, like completely. It's interesting because so my dad's side of the family, my dad's Jamaican, my mom is Grenadian. So we always had these basement parties, barbecues in the backyard, and music and dancing and food and celebration was always a part of that. So that social aspect of the dance was always there, which is why I was able to kind of fall in love with jazz dance, because they're social dances, right? Jazz is a social dance that was like, that was done in the clubs or in the ballrooms or on the dance floors. So I think having that that cultural tradition with my family, it was able for me to translate that into my jazz dance, because it's a dance where you're dancing with, you're really inspired by the other people that are around you in the space. So I felt like that really kind of lent and kind of inspired and by the same traditions as well.
I find that Jamaica is one of those places that we hear about that is always renowned for its music and its food. What do you think is the most underappreciated part of Jamaican culture?
Ah, oh, that is such a unique question. I would say it's history. I think we don't hear enough about where Jamaica's come from and where it is now. And I think that goes for a lot of things. Like, we're concentrated on like what's happening now and how things are moving forward. But a huge part of that is the history of the country. So when they finally got freedom after 300 years, the Ska movement, that was a huge part of that celebration of gaining their freedom and how that's translated over time. And I think that's a huge part of it. It's always been a celebration of freedom, a celebration of community, and a celebration of hope for a brighter future. So I think that's always kind of been something that's kind of been not really acknowledged or kind of forgotten about.
And I know you as well, in addition to your many appearances on stage, you've also appeared on film and television. You were in The L Word, Spectacular. And I'm curious, how does your approach change at all when you're on stage versus when you're in front of a bunch of cameras?
Yeah, it definitely does. Like, for example, usually when you're on set and you're on film, there's multiple opportunities to do multiple takes until they get the right one, right? Versus when you're on stage, you've got one shot. You've got one opportunity to kind of have your moment. And there's no like, oh, can we stop and start again type of thing. So it's like you're almost always on, and like the comfort level that you have to have with yourself, with the space around you, makes it a huge difference. So there's this kind of adrenaline that happens on stage because sometimes you don't know what's going to happen. And it's kind of like the magic that's created in the moment, which is what I love about stage.
When I was reading the press release for this, I came across a word I was unfamiliar with before, and that is jook, J-O-O-K. Mm-hmm. And I know it came from a book that you read. How would you describe what juke and juking is?
Yeah, so a juke joint is what they called it probably in the 1920s, 30s. It was like old, poly, rundown spaces or environments where blacks in the United States could gather. It was primarily after emancipation, where they could gather and have time for, like, after work, you'd go out, you'd party, you would drink, you would dance. There's a lot of gambling in these spaces. So that's what a juke house or a juke joint is. And juking is basically the dancing that happens in that space. So a juke house and a juke joint are similar to the same thing. And juking is the dancing that's happening in the space.
And I know with Floored, well, which is your next event coming up on April 25th, it's saying how we're going to come face to face with all that, all the vernacular and the style of juke. Would you describe Floored as a throwback, a tribute, or a mixture of the two?
I would say it's your last one. It's kind of a mixture of the two. What we're trying to do really is, it's a little bit of a throwback, but at the same time, we're trying to interpret it in a modern day context, right? So we want to be authentic to our experiences and what we are having now, but at the same time, we're inspired by, the Charleston and like those old dances that they did in those spaces. And we're also dancing to jazz music, so that also changes the type of movement that we're doing. So it's actually really exciting to see, younger people doing jazz in, like, a today context, which is why we're really excited to share this work with people. Because sometimes people think of, like, jazz and Charleston as, like, oh, that was, like, a back-in-the-day thing. But, people are still doing it now. There's lots of spaces and places in Toronto for people to go out and do these types of dances, and this type of work is an opportunity to share that.
It seems that every decade or every few years, society revisits cultural, traditions or things that happened 50, 60, 70 years ago. And it seems this year, a lot of the talk has been around African-American culture. You've got Black Panther, you've got a lot of, there was Moonlight a couple years ago. How would you describe where we are in our sort of recognition now of African American or West African culture, and how do you think Floored adds to that conversation?
I think we're slowly getting there. I feel like we're in this generation of young people who have seen the legacy that our ancestors or our elders have kind of created a space for us to actually be out there and, taking ownership of all the things that we've created, all the things that have been shared and sharing it with the community. So I feel like we're in a nice place now, but I think there's a lot more work to do. And I think that's why Floored is so important, because a lot of people think jazz is more linked to more ballet, Euro-European type of dance. And when I explained to them that actually, no, jazz dancing is actually more connected to West African traditions, it actually makes them curious about, oh, they want to learn more. So I think the more these conversations are happening, movies, television, dance shows are happening in the city and just in the broader public, it's an opportunity for people to recognize where things are created and how they're created and how we can acknowledge that and move forward from there.
Now, I know in creating this piece, you worked a lot with Gerald Heslop. What was the process like for you in terms of from conception to working on all the choreography, and now you're getting ready to stage it next week?
Yeah, so I actually worked with Gerald back in 2014 on a dance production that we did together. And when I asked him to do this, I was like, you know, I wanted to concentrate more on the jazz element. So he assembled the musicians that he felt like would be the right fit for the project. And I went through some music that I thought could be a good fit, and I shared it with him, and he would kind of give me like, yeah, we can do this, this is what we'll need. And then he would come into rehearsal and see what the dancers are doing. And so when he's seeing what the dancers are doing movement-wise, it inspired him to kind of get a sense of where he wants to take the musical direction of the score. So it's actually really exciting to kind of see how the dancing is also inspiring the music and the music's inspiring the dancing. So actually there's this cohesive relationship that's happening.
Now, I know jazz music has a reputation and renown for being very sort of loose and improvisational at times. And I get a sense that certain types of jazz dance can be like that as well, which seems to go against everything we know about sort of the rigid choreography of very high-end dance. How did you find balancing those two worlds?
It's great because I'm working with some really awesomely talented dancers. So they're able to fluidly move from improvisation into choreography. So there's this kind of even flow of moving in from like a solo improvisation or duet improvisation into a group choreography. So they're really aware of like, we've created a structure with the piece and they're able to move in and out of it at the same time. So it's, they're awesome. The dancers are great. So it's keeping that tradition of improvisation, but at the same time, having the score and the choreography that's kind of pushing it as well. So there's this like continuum. You kind of never know where things are going next. You're kind of wondering, okay, what's going to happen next? So it kind of keeps people a little bit curious as to where it's going to go.
When doing a piece like this, what is your research like in terms of, you know, the specific period or maybe the style of dress that they wore? I know you worked a little bit with both Monsell Durden and then Katrina Hazard-Gordon back in 2013, but how much of that history and that research is a factor when creating a piece like this?
It's definitely influenced and inspired by, but my main influences as well, like as a huge part, obviously the book and my research in New York was definitely key, but the bodies, the dancing bodies are actually a huge part of the work as well, because I need to see what they're capable of, what's inspiring them as well, because it needs to be also true to the artist and true to the dancer and what excites them, what gets them moving. So I find that really exciting to kind of see where the music and where the movement takes them, where their outfits take them, because when they come to rehearsal, they're not just like, you know, in a leotard or a bodysuit. They're kind of like the gentlemen are decked off in like a dress pants. They'll have like a little fedora hat on. And the ladies, they'll be either in a dress or like a skirt, a pencil skirt, and have like a little heel on. So what they wear also influences how they dance as well. And that changes from day to day. So it's exciting to kind of see that evolve over time and see that resonate in the dance show as well.
Now, it's funny, I understand this is sort of taking place right before International Jazz Day, which I must confess I didn't know was a thing until I read this press release. What do you think is a misconception people have about jazz music and the whole culture surrounding jazz?
I think, based on, you know, some of the people that I've spoken to and that are close to me, I think a lot of people didn't understand what jazz meant as a celebration of freedom, as a celebration of unity, as a purpose of expression. I think they didn't know how to receive the music, and they kind of also viewed it as like dinner time music. And there's many subgenres of jazz, and there's different ways to interpret the music, and that there's jazz music that swings that you can dance to as well. So I think if people maybe, if there were more resources and more things out there to show people, to help them realize that, you know, you don't have to just sit at dinner and listen to jazz. You can dance to it, you can swing to it, or you can just sit and listen as well. There's different ways to enjoy the music, and it can be expressed in so many different ways, expressed in music and expressed in dance as well.
Well, the show is Floored, F-L-O-O-R apostrophe D, and it runs April 25th to the 28th at the Winchester Street Theater. Natasha Powell, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Dan. Hope to see you soon.
All righty, have a good day. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
And that was my conversation with Natasha Powell, the artistic director of Hall of Jazz and choreographer of Floored, the world premiere of which is April 25th to 28th at the Winchester Street Theater. That does it for the show today. Taking you out with Liam Cormier's favorite song off of The Spark That Moves. This is Cancer Bats with Space and Time. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.